Thank you very, very much, Ansgar, and thank you all for being here. So I'd like to begin by breaking the ice and ask you, as I did in my class on this subject, where were you when 9/11 happened? Do you remember? How about you, sir? Thank you. The point that I want to get to is that this is a shared event that we've had. And I would argue, I'm 46, that for my generation, it is a determining historical moment. That whereas for my parents, the question of where were you when JFK died, when he was shot in 1963, or where were you when Martin Luther King was shot, or Bobby Kennedy, those were the determining moments. But for my generation, it's really 9/11. And what is interesting, because this was such a global media event, is that that's not just the case for Americans. I find it is for Germans as well, though many of you may still have been, most of you, in school. And it's interesting to think about how you would mark historical time. Many of you would perhaps be too young, but if it would be the fall of the Berlin Wall, or what historical event you particularly remember, where you remember being there. What I'm going to be doing today is first talking about, and as I say, it's a lot of information, the visuality and mediation of 9/11, and how that particular kind of visuality transfers into a mode that most of us here in this room, if we study literary and cultural studies, are more familiar with in novels and prose novels. I'm going to talk about problems of definitions of 9/11 and names, about how 9/11 is indeterminate in its meaning, it has no fixed meaning, types of 9/11 texts. Then I'm going to give a very brief reading of an Abu Ghraib text and talk about the ethics involved in the analysis. And then we're going to look very briefly at a memorial video and talk about some of the ways to analyze that, some of the things that you might do. So one of my first theses is that 9/11 was a highly visual and enormously successful, enormously large media event. And I'd like to just recall with you how that was, how we experienced that together. This is as it was actually happening. The first tower, the North Tower, had been hit. People still didn't know what was happening. The only thing that's been added is the ticker tape at the bottom. This was a feature that was added after 9/11. Okay. Some of the things that were mentioned by you that came up, the young woman down here said it looked like it was a movie, even for somebody on the scene. And this was a unique media event 2 minutes after the first plane hit the North Tower. CNN had live coverage, which was followed very quickly by other stations. It looked like a disaster movie. It mimicked the plot of disaster movie. It mimicked that spectacular large quality. And as you can see, it was a participatory event because news stations were covering it large, were trying to figure it out. Was this an accident? Did another bomb go off as a bomb went off in 1993? People not knowing. And a relative calmness, the first correspondent, and then the second young woman getting fairly hysterical after the second plane hit, understandably so. How is it with light? You're going to be able to read the PowerPoint better. You're going to be able to see a little bit less of me. Should we leave it like this so you can read better? Okay. David Levi Strauss, an art historian, says, on September 11th, more people clicked on documentary news photographs than on pornography for the first and only time in the history of the Internet. In other words, a kind of mediation. And in terms of people's interest, I would argue that most of us were there at 9/11 in some way, through mediation. It was a televised event. Most people who experienced September 11th did so not as survivors or eyewitnesses, but as TV watchers who turned in either during the real time of the attacks or in the hours after they occurred. It is estimated that by the end of the day, as many as 2 billion people worldwide had seen footage of the burning and collapsing towers. Moreover, it became the source of news for those who were in rescuing missions. The military and the Federal Aviation Association learned of the attacks by watching television, like practically everyone else. So that the television image became more real and the source of information than eyewitness reports. Anne Kaplan, drawing on theory of memory and trauma culture, has written a book in which she compares her own experience of being a child during the bombings in London of World War II with what it was like to be near so-called Ground Zero at the time of the September attacks. She points out that our sense of proximity or distance to a trauma is proximate, that emotional and actual geographic distance often depends on how we see or witness the experience through how it's mediated. People encounter trauma by being a bystander, by living near to where a catastrophe happened, or by hearing about a crisis from a friend. But most people encounter trauma through the media, which is why focusing on so-called mediatized trauma is important. That's the way most of us live through it, and arguably, in something that's called virtual trauma, the way most Americans lived it. 9/11 has a particular visuality, and that has to do, we are as human beings, I would argue, particularly a visual species, but I'd also argue with Susan Sontag that we have come to store and know about experiences overwhelmingly through photographs and through film, particularly in the last century and in this century. In a modern society, images made by cameras are the principal access to realities of which we have no direct experience. Our epistemology, our way of knowing, comes through photographs. In the modern way of knowing, there have to be images for something to become real. Photographs identify events. Photographs confer importance on events and make them memorable. For a war, an atrocity, a pandemic, a so-called natural catastrophe to become a subject of a large concern, it has to reach people through the various systems, from television and the internet to newspapers and magazines, that diffuse photographic images to millions. 9/11 and so-called virtual trauma. I was already in Germany, a number of students, North American students, who came back in the fall of 2001 and said to me, "Greta," as I'm known to my students, "I haven't been able to work, I haven't been able to read, I haven't been able to work for the last month. I've just been watching footage of 9/11. It's so awful." Instances of this can be called virtual trauma, a kind of trauma that has come through mediatized images of the event. We know about 9/11, we understand it, it has become comprehensible and constructed. And this is what's important, through the selection, highlighting, dissemination, and suppression of certain images. What I'm saying is that the way we know 9/11 is not neutral. It has been constructed. And I want to examine some of the ways how it has been constructed. This visuality of the event transfers into a form that I would suggest, I suppose, many of you are more comfortable with in analyzing than you perhaps are in still and in moving images and film. And that is 9/11. And in three very prominent post-9/11 novels, visuality plays a central and the central role. And I would argue this is in response to the actual event and how most of us experienced it through its visuality. Jonathan Safran Foer's very popular, extremely loud, and incredibly close plays with a child protagonist, Oscar Schell, the reference to Blechtrommel is there and is meant to be there. He has lost his father in the attacks on the World Trade Centers, and he is traumatized. His sense of psychic disjointedness is mirrored by the form of the novel. It is achronological, it's multivocal, and it mixes other narrations of loss, for instance, his grandparents' loss of the person they loved most in the Dresden firebombings, and by its particular visuality. The scattered images reflect the destruction of the towers as well as the child's peace. His attempt to reverse the images of the so-called falling man at the end of the book is an effort to reverse the passage of time. So we have an achronological development, Oscar's experiences a few years after the attacks, losing his father, his non-chronological description of a kind of quest that occurs from him finding what he believes is a clue from his father, is offset or intercepted with doodlings, photographs, letters from his grandfather that were unsent, his father's circling of the New York Times. This all, though, begins to make sense. And at the end of the novel, we see one of the most famous and controversial series of photographs called The Falling Man, one of the many who chose to die, to commit suicide, to jump off the North Tower, rather than to be suffocated or burned to death by fire. He reverses these images in a flip book. And this, of course, is a very appropriate modus for a child. I don't know if you, when you were bored in school, also wrote doodles on your notebooks. So when you flip through, you could make a primitive movie. I'll hand that around so you can see what it looks like. This reversal of the image is Oscar's effort at the end of the narration to turn back time, to have his father literally go back in time to the night before September 11th occurred. And he sees his father going backwards, as in a film, brushing his teeth backwards, etc. Was criticized very heavily in reviews for making too much light of a miserable and traumatic event in American history. It also, however, this is my main point, is commenting on the visual impact of 9/11 itself. In a novel that I would very greatly recommend to you, Mohsin Hamid's The Reluctant Fundamentalist, a novel with a misleading title. The fundamentalism is not militant Islamist, as you might suppose, but more a fundamentalism of capitalism, which the protagonist turns away from. He, a young man from Pakistan who is made good, is fulfilling the American dream, has come as an excellent scholar and a superb soccer player to Princeton, where he has had a sterling career, graduated, gotten a job in industry in an evaluation firm in New York, and is dating a young American woman named Erica, get the play, America. Finds while he is in Manila that on an assignment in which he's been asked to assess how much a firm is worth before it is taken apart, finds himself, first of all, feeling more like those people who live in Manila than the very white, very middle-class men he works with. And in a scene where he is alone in his room, he describes seeing 9/11. The following evening was supposed to be our last in Manila. I was in my room, packing my things. I turned on the television and saw what at first I took to be a film. But as I continued to watch, I realized that it was not fiction, but news. I stared as one and then the other of the twin towers of New York's World Trade Center collapsed. And then I smiled. Yes, despicable as it may sound, my initial reaction was to be remarkably pleased. Again, the central moment is one of seeing, of visualizing, very much an experience that most of us who did not actually survive the attacks shared. Finally, another superb post 9/11 novel, Don DeLillo's Falling Man. The title, of course, is a play on the very famous and controversial photographs by Richard Drew, the man leaping, falling from the tower, which was censored by the American press. Yet it also refers to a performance artist who in the novel reenacts deaths by, without any kind of advertising beforehand, jumps from places around Manhattan, very much to the consternation of people who see him, and without safety devices is caught by primitive loops which catch him. It is, of course, a reference to the famous photographs. DeLillo's Falling Man is both hated by the New York populace, also arrested at times as a public nuisance, and he eventually commits suicide. But at the same time, he is invited to academic conferences which are dedicated to him. So both sides of spectacle, the sometimes voyeuristic academic response to it and very visceral everyday woman and man's response to it are referenced in this novel. And you see the central image is one of the overwhelming visuality of the moment. Here in the cover, you see it, the absence of the two towers. I'd like to talk about what the naming of 9/11 means and what its implications are. All of these terms, 9/11, Ground Zero, the Global War on Terrorism, GWT for short, are controversial ones. They cannot be used blithely. As Derrida wrote very shortly after the attacks, we do not in fact know what we are saying or naming in this way. September 11th, le 11 septembre, September 11, the brevity of the appellation, September 11, 9/11, stems not only from an economic or rhetorical necessity. Derrida goes on to say that we have named the event, made it into a monument by turning it into a 9/11 avenir, before we actually know what it means. Perhaps 9/11 is, and he was right in this, the first of a number of terrorist attacks. Perhaps those to come will be much worse. The telegram of this metonymy, a name, a number, points out the unquantifiable by recognizing that we do not recognize or even cognize, that we do not yet know how to qualify, that we do not know what we are talking about. We use this metonymy, this shorthand 9/11, because we don't know yet what it means. What does the name do? Why should we care about it? Why is it controversial? The formal minimalism of the name date would be nugatory. It wouldn't matter in its effects were it not for the name date's endless repetition as a mantra within a consumer culture within which all other dates, times, places, acts, or meanings melt into the air. The naked phrase, September 11th, rhetorically reperforms that ignorance, and the global hegemony of American media and culture imposes the sign of the erasure worldwide. In other words, September 11th can't stand in anymore for any other historical event which might have happened at other times and at other places, also within Germany. It now stands in only for the American tragedy. The naming of Ground Zero, it comes from military terminology, and it means the place where the nuclear bomb has dropped, the site. This is a reversal. Of course, it's an imagery working on the idea of the towers collapsing so dramatically and horrible. But it is also a reversing of the direction of the metaphor to become a justification of war. The bombing was here, hence the response will be retaliatory. And its definition, Ground Zero, is the target of a projectile or the site directly below the point of detonation of a nuclear weapon. Finally, the global war on terror. In the first months after the attacks, it was referred to as the war on terrorism. This became, however, much broader, the war on terror, much vaguer, much harder to pinpoint whom are we fighting against. It justifies the state of exception. If the United States is at war, the president may take on extreme powers that would not be granted to him under other circumstances. Citizens, as Sontag criticizes, rather than terrorists, will suffer from the rhetoric of war because it justifies a retaliatory war, first in Afghanistan and Iraq. It will not be precise. It will not hit those who produce terror, but those around them. The metaphor of war, as Sontag continues, is being misused to justify retaliation. What are the consequences of this naming? 9/11 determines also, and you can see this yourself if you Google a timeline of 9/11, either in German or in English. If you Google a timeline of 9/11 or use another search engine, you'll see that 9/11 determines where history begins. Most begin within minutes before the first plane crashed into the North Tower, or when the first plane left the Boston Logan Airport on the morning of September 11th. If they are more generous in their scope of history, they will reference the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. They will not, however, go back and see in a large frame historical mode or a global mode what came before the attacks, which was the U.S.-supported Soviet-Afghan War from 1979 to 1988, or events in U.S. foreign policy beforehand. 9/11 has also become a trademark and an advertisement for consumerism. So are you looking for a few goodies for your parents for Christmas? I found these on the internet just yesterday. They are available by mail. You will recall that we Americans were told that the way that we could be patriotic after the attacks was to go out and buy. Indeed, in these memorabilia, we are fulfilling both. We are not forgetting the wounding of America. On the left, you see the two towers rendered in the one side as an American flag, the South Tower, and on the right, appropriate for our season, a Christmas ornament. And if you see, rather macabre if you ask me, since we have used real light candles on our trees, you can see that the hanger of the ornament says NY, New York. These are cultural and consumerist artifacts of remembrance. In them, and there were also, in very bad tastes, T-shirts and sweatshirts after the attack saying, "I survived 9/11. The survivor becomes confused with the consumer. On the left, you see a commemorative medallion, the towers already attacked in flames. And on the right, the sweatshirt, still very commonly available. I was just in New York, showing the absence of the towers on the American flag as a way of remembering. What does 9/11 mean? I'd argue that 9/11 does not have one meaning. It was in the United States, and I'm quoting, two general large responses. It created a paradigm change. This was a phrase that Bush used in one of his speeches and has been used repeatedly afterwards. There was a new sense of vulnerability. On the evening of September 11th, 2001, President George W. Bush wrote in his diary, the Pearl Harbor of the 21st century took place today. Of course, Hawaii in 1941 was not yet a state of America, of the United States. It was a territory. It was not also on the fest land of America. As many argue, this attack being likened to Pearl Harbor is ahistorical and is again used for purposes of justifying retaliation. However, it was a common way in the United States of seeing the attack. And it witnessed a desire for retaliation. Again, quoting Bush, America was targeted for attack because we're the brightest beacon for freedom and opportunity in the world. And no one will keep that light from shining. America has stood down enemies before, and we will do this so this time. None of us will ever forget this day, yet we go forward to defend freedom and all that is good and just in our world. According to this understanding, this was an entirely unannounced, cruel attack, which had had no history that went before it. The paradigm change in America, the results of which we still live with today, were incursions on civil and human rights. To name just a few of those in all brevity, the U.S. Patriot Act, enacted all too quickly by Congress on October 26 in 2001, allowed surveillance properties and practices towards American citizens, such as wiretapping, without having to go to a judge beforehand to prove reasonable doubt. It also allowed new and quite undue, harsh behavior towards immigrants in the United States. So it actually was an incursion on American rights as well as the rights of those we dealt with. In the year after 2001 occurred, there were 600 attacks on mosques, Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, and Sikhs, originally a religion from India, but with men wearing turbans and long beards. As it has been said, they look more like bin Laden than bin Laden himself. Often these people were mistaken for Muslims and attacked. Operation Enduring Freedom, a nice euphemism for the entrance into the attack on Afghanistan in the winter of 2001-2002. The opening of secret internment centers or black sites around the world, where either held by Americans or run by foreign governments, terrorist subjects could be held, questioned, and tortured. The opening of the Guantanamo camp, a place without jurisdiction, rented from Cuba by America, a no man's land, where a jail was set up, where people had no due process of law and could be held there indefinitely, and the use of torture. There were, of course, other responses to 9/11, and I'm going to give you just a few of them. The philosopher Jean Baudrillard: this is not a clash of civilizations or religions, as was one of the ways that Bush had described it, referring very strongly to a book by Huntington called The Clash of Civilizations that explained this conflict as being a clash between the West, Muslim societies, and the West, Judeo-Christian societies, and the East, Muslim societies, on which efforts are being made to focus the conflict in order to create the delusion of a visible confrontation and a solution based upon force. Suicidal terrorism was the terrorism of the poor. This is the terrorism of the rich, and that is what specially frightens us. They've become rich, they have every means without ceasing to want to eradicate us. Certainly, according to our value system, they cheat, staking, gambling one's own life is cheating, but they could not care less, and the new rules of the game are not ours.
The combination of having the technology, the know-how, and the ability to get to the planes to carry out this enormous event, and the passion of suicidal bombers, that is what made this event so difficult to understand. Zizek responding, "Now in the days immediately following the bombings, it is as if we dwell in the unique time between a traumatic event and its symbolic impact. Like in those brief moments after we are deeply cut and before the full extent of the pain strikes us." He's echoing something that Derrida also said, that we do not yet know what it means. We do not yet have the terms for comprehending it. Either America will persist in, strengthen even, the attitude of why should this happen to us? Things like this don't happen here, leading to more aggressivity towards the threatening outside, in short, to a paranoid acting out. Or America will finally risk stepping through the phantasmic screen separating it from the outside world, accepting its arrival into the real world, making the long overdue move from a thing like this should not happen here to a thing like this should not happen anywhere. America's holiday from history was a fake. America's peace was brought out by the catastrophes going on elsewhere. Therein resides the true lesson of the bombings. The only way to ensure that it will not happen here again is to prevent it going on anywhere else. Zizek is making an interesting argument. This huge, spectacular event, which lent, and again, 9/11 is constantly compared to a disaster movie, which borrowed from the imagery of a large-scale Hollywood movie, was used, this very American image, to show how America had been living in a kind of dream, or to borrow from the Matrix, to borrow from the films of that name, a false world of images. The image crashed through that false image to present the specter, what cannot be taken in American political isolationism. And to quote an American intellectual, Don DeLillo, why the World Trade Centers? They have a particular symbolic and, of course, a visual quality. The World Trade Center's towers were not only an emblem of advanced technology, but a justification and a sense for technology's irresistible will to realize in solid form whatever becomes theoretically allowable. It was, for a brief time, you remember, the tallest building in the world. Now, a small group of men have literally altered our skyline. We have fallen back in time and space. It is their technology that marks our moments, the small, lethal devices, the remote-controlled detonators they fashion out of radios, or the larger technology they borrow from us, passenger jets that become manned missiles. Finally, 9/11 is not only indeterminate what it means. It depends very much, like our relationship to the trauma of the event, where we stood to it, how we stand to it politically, how much distance we have from it. But it is also overdetermined. Too many meanings have been projected onto it and laid on top of it. Today, 9/11 carries so many burdens of interpretation, of sentimentality, of politics, of war, that sometimes it's hard to find the rubble of the actual event beneath the layers of edifice we've built on top of it, or built on top of all of it except ground zero. I now want to talk about how 9/11 has been remembered, some of the dominant norms for the way that we think about it and have come to commemorate it and to visualize it, if I would say so, in our national consciousness. It has been, just as in fiction or in any aesthetic work, a process of selection, highlighting, and elimination. Some, I would say, anesthetized images of the attacks have been chosen. They have become the representative ones. On the left, you see a very famous photograph taken by Thomas Franklin not long after the attacks, a few hours after most of the rubble and dirt and dust and all the debris in the air had settled. And that was the raising of the American flag by three firemen, of course, the heroes of the day. Many died trying to save others. Now, he took hundreds of photographs, but this one was chosen, infinitely reproduced, put on souvenirs, sold everywhere, eventually in 2002 made into a postage stamp, because, as the image on the right shows you, it recalls a historical, resonant moment of American bravery, America at war. In the Second World War, a photograph by Jill Rosenthal of soldiers raising the flag at Iwo Jima. Whereas some, I would say, anesthetized images were chosen, some others were left out or elided. I've spoken already about the fallen man, a aesthetically beautiful, also very troubling image of a man falling, jumping from the North Tower, the first tower that was hit. This photograph by an AP, Associated Press photographer, appeared very widely in newspapers on September 12th. It was then self-censored in the American media. It was considered too obscene and upsetting. Similarly, photos of bodies, and there were many bodies who jumped from the North Tower, those in the South Tower didn't have time, were censored from the media. And some international journalists complained that they were simply not allowed to record what was actually happening. Whereas Friedman's image, that's the image that we just saw, opens up the space for a narrative of hope and triumph through the promise of national revenge, Drew's falling man resist all such linkages with American glory. If bodies are largely absent, dead, mangled bodies, one body in leaping from the North Tower fell on a fireman and killed him. These bodies largely go absent in commemorations of 9/11. Only one is very frequently shown. You'll also find this if you Google or use any search engine of 9/11. You will find this image almost infinitely reproduced. This was the first official death of the 9/11 tragedy. A very loved, very well-known father, Michael Judge, who was the chaplain for the fire department. While he was giving the last rites to a fireman who had died, he was hit by falling debris. Now note that this dead person can be shown. He did something purposeful, and there's an element of choice in his death. He was doing something heroic. All of those who were truly vulnerable, who were stuck, who chose to die by jumping rather than asphyxiating by fire, have been elided. Another aspect of commemoration is the predominance of first-person narratives. And there are infinite amounts of film material footage remembering 9/11. Very often, you will have a survivor story or the story of someone who lost someone and crying. Judith Butler commenting on this, and we remember from the narratologist Stanzel that automatically when someone speaks in the first person, we feel closer. We feel a sense of privileging and proximity. In the U.S., we start the story by invoking a first-person narrative point of view and tell what happened on September 11th. We have to shore up this first-person point of view and preclude from the telling accounts that might involve a decentering of the narrative I within the international political domain. This decentering is precisely what we seek to rectify through a recentering. A narrative form emerges to compensate for the enormous narcissistic wound opened up by the public display of our own physical vulnerability. Just as 9/11
This acronym, this name for a series of events, stands in and precludes everything else that happened in other places and at other times on September 11th. Similarly, the first-person story of American suffering says this is the only story. There are no others. Other features of what I would call normative commemoration. There are, of course, subversive and different kinds of ways of remembering these events, but these are the major ones, the ones that reify, that strengthen the central story of what we should feel and think and remember about 9/11. Attestations of never forgetting. We're going to be looking at a memorial video. There are hundreds of these. Never forget. This is the 8th, 9th anniversary. Never forget what occurred. Attestations of never forgetting love and loss, American unity. Presence of symbols such as the American eagle, the American flag, and the cross. Very strongly, the juxtaposition of Christianity and the events of suffering, also sacrifice for others and survival of 9/11. Heroicizing of firefighters and the World Trade Center, and this is historically interesting, becomes to stand in for all of the attacks. And you recall it was not just the Twin Towers that were destroyed. About 11 buildings around the Twin Towers were destroyed. They were simply not as spectacular as those two huge, once tallest buildings in the world falling down. The Pentagon was attacked. But within about a year after September 11th, the Pentagon imagery was widely elided. Similarly, Flight 93, probably on its way to the White House or the Capitol, which was overcome by passengers and crashed in a field in Pennsylvania, it pretty much got wiped out. Again, just as the name 9/11 stands in for a complex historical event, the image of the towers collapsing stands in for everything that occurred. And as I've been saying at some length now, perhaps at too much length, the discourse of 9/11 is primarily visual. I want to give you a brief overview, and this is going to be very brief because I want to get into analysis of the kinds of 9/11 texts they are, just so that if you're thinking about 9/11 studies or investigating this further, you have an idea of what kind of text you could be working with. We have documentaries, of course. Now, documentaries purporting to be true are, of course, like still photographs, the process of selection, elimination, and highlighting. I want to recommend very strongly 9/11 by Jules and Gideon Naudet. They were filming, actually, a rookie fireman becoming a real fireman. And he and the rest of his company were called into the towers. It's a very powerful documentary. Fahrenheit 9/11, very provocative. Michael Moore's assertion that this was 9/11 happened because of Bush's ties with the Saudi Arabian family. Loose Change, this is the conspiracy film about 9/11. Standard operating procedure, also very much to recommend, a documentary about torture in Abu Ghraib. Then we have big budget Hollywood movies. The first two can be named in one breath. World Trade Center and United 93, I would argue, perform in the same way as most of the still photographs and images I've been talking about. They increase, they're very visual. They also, in a weird sense, because the attacks on the towers were quoting imagery from disaster movies, they take that and bring it back into the realm of a disaster movie again. They also work in very claustrophobic spaces, both of them. World Trade Center shows it's a fictionalization of a true story, two firemen who were trapped in a shaft of one of the towers and covered with debris who were eventually found by a Marine. and United 93, the fictional account of those passengers who overwhelmed the flight so that it could not become another destructive missile. Very much to recommend is Rendition, whom some people in my class on 9/11 watched with me. This is a fictional story of how the practice of extrajudicial rendition works. This was a practice that began during the Clinton era, in which terrorist suspects were picked up and taken again to other countries, such as Egypt, where they could be interrogated, held without charge, and sometimes tortured. And in the unusual field of humor and 9/11, there's Harold and Kumar, Escape from Guantanamo. Both of these dark-skinned, incredibly American young men are thought to be terrorist suspects, taken to Guantanamo and managed to get away. It is making fun of some of the racism in America in post 9/11. In literary fiction, I've already spoken of novels. There's an excellent play based on real letters sent from British detainees to their family called Guantanamo, Honor Bound to Defend Freedom. The subtitle refers to the motto, which is above Camp Delta in Guantanamo, that the soldiers there are honor bound to defend freedom. It's, of course, ironic, since abuse and torture has occurred there. Television series, the most important of which is 24, which I'm going to mention again. Again, I would argue that torture in the media and what occurred at Abu Ghraib got picked up and also dealt with in other series, such as Alias and Lost. In the visual arts and the memorials and memorial videos, just to give you an idea of what's out there. I want to talk very briefly about one of the most disturbing post 9/11 texts, was actually began just before the attacks on September 11th, but became incredibly popular afterwards. Who here has seen or heard about 24? Okay, not very many of you. The motto of 24 and its protagonist is whatever it takes. Whatever it takes to save the United States. Each episode of 24 depicts an hour in real time of counter-terrorist unit Jack Bauer's fight to save the United States from conspiracies, bombs, and terrorism. Given the ticking bomb scenarios that present themselves, for instance, if he doesn't torture suspect B, 8 million people in Los Angeles will die in 2 minutes. Of course he tortures. Of course Los Angeles is saved. Torture always works. It's always clean. And everyone is always saved. Very disturbingly, Jack's behavior and his motto, whatever it takes, has been cited as a model for West Point cadets. Those are our military officers in the field in Iraq of how they should deal with terrorist suspects. If Jack Bauer does it, why can't I? The Bush administration and even Supreme Court Justice Scalia. Just to give you an idea of what 9/11 looks like, it is, and here it is, I would say, quoting a trope of the news, and it is quoting that idea of that state of exception that we had with the beginning of 9/11. We have split screen. So we have potentially up to four different narratives going on at the same time. Every hour of the show, it turns out to be 40 minutes because of commercials, goes on in the supposedly real time of Jack Bauer's and his associates' life. You have a clock running all the time, so a sense of adrenaline. Again, the necessity of enormous action. This mimics the state of war. It also looks the way that a news screen in America very much looks since 9/11. I mentioned in that first footage that since 9/11, because what was happening was considered so important and groundbreaking, that they've put a ticker tape at the bottom of a news screen, so you get more news in addition to script screening. I want to talk very briefly about textual analysis and reading Abu Ghraib. For me, one of the most disturbing bodies of text that have come out of 9/11, these being the torture photographs of Iraqi, most of them civilians, they weren't soldiers, in the then American-held prison, Abu Ghraib. Have an image of Private Lindy England posing with a prisoner on a leash. And there's a lot to be said with here. He's being made into an animal, a leash around his neck. He's being made into an it. His clothes have been taken off, a traditional trope of civilization. He has been made into the subject of abuse. Lindy is alternately in her pose interpreted as a dominatrix in a sadomasochist scenario, or as a puppet herself who is taking orders from her officer and from her then boyfriend. The so-called hooded man, a man who believed that he'd be electrocuted if he put down his arms. This was the first photograph that broke very disturbingly in the spring of 2004. Doing a Lindy, an expression which has disturbingly become a part of American and global vocabulary. That is, sorry, I know it always hurts when I do that. You hold, when you are expressing disgust and contempt for somebody, you pretend to be shooting a gun off at them. This is an image that has been now quoted and reinterpreted in any number of American shows, like American Guy, and has also become a Google doing a Lindy, a way of expressing contempt, particularly disturbing if you see it done towards another human being. Now, this is one of the most disturbing reinterpretations of these texts, reifying that same ideology of having the right to subject the person who's under your control to your contempt, to your figurative gun. This has not, however, been the only interpretation of these images. One of the most powerful commentaries on the photographs is again by Susan Sontag, whom you'll find me quoting a lot today in the New York Times regarding the torture of us. She says the photographs are us, a play on that great American store, Toys R Us. No, the horror of what is shown in the photographs cannot be separated from the horror that the photographs were taken, with the perpetrators posing, gloating over their helpless captives. In other words, it's not just what they are doing, it is the evident glee they take, smiling, having a good time, passing the photographs around. They were disseminated on CDs, like pornography, or as a kind of trophy. There is something comparable to what these pictures show. It would be some of the photographs of black victims of lynching taken between the 1880s and the 1930s, which show Americans grinning beneath the naked, mutilated body of a black man or woman hanging behind them from a tree. Lynching photographs show, particularly in the American South in the post-Civil War era, how civilians took it upon themselves to discipline blacks by torturing them and hanging them up, and then took smiling pictures of themselves or had pictures taken. Very often pieces of clothing were taken too. Sontag suggests, I know these lights, they're tricky. Sontag suggests that the photographs have a similarly disturbing import. Moreover, it's not just what we see in the photographs, it's all the things that we imagine happening that weren't actually recorded. Here we go. Thank you. Okay. I have to do this briefly because I want to do a piece of analysis with you of a 9/11 text at more length. But there are a number of ethical and representational difficulties when we get into even talking about these photographs. In some very powerful arguments and texts, people have argued that these photographs should not be shown because we are perpetrating a form of objectification. We are turning these poor, miserable souls who were tortured, some of them killed, abused by Americans. We are now taking that picture of their objectification and passing it around and commenting on it. And in these pictures, these were taken as trophies. We, when we look at them, and this is the way I want you to start to think about, what does the photograph do to you? We are taking on the picture, on the position of the person who took the photograph or who got off on it, who wanted it, who saw it as something good and worthwhile. So some argue these photographs should not be shown at all. Or some others say that if you're working with these photographs that actually objectify Iraqi civilians and turn them into animal-like non-human beings, then you have to frame them or contextualize them with other kinds of photographs of Iraqis, which show them as individuals, as human beings, being parents, working, doing whatever they do. The Abu Ghraib photographs, and this has been the aspect which has perhaps been concentrated on most, bring up some very difficult and troubling gender analyses. One is the shocking image certainly for me, of seeing a woman, and there are two women that are featured very frequently. One is Lindy Ingwin, the other one is Sabrina Harmon, of torturing people. And this may get back to some sexist idea, some essentialist idea that I have, that women should be morally better than men. Any assumption that I may have is radically disturbed by these images. Another difficult business is, what do we do with the sexuality of the photographs? There is a quoting of pornography. There is a quoting of images from porn, and that is disturbing. For someone, this was supposed to be stimulating, was supposed to get them off. How do we see the woman in these pictures? Is she the active one? Is she the dominatrix? Is she dominating? Or is she in a very hierarchical, paternalistic system, simply taking orders and being the woman by turning an Iraqi prisoner into an even less empowered bitch, animal, girl in this sexual scenario? Similarly, when we look at these photographs, we have to deal with the animality of what we see. The prisoners were made to crawl around on all fours, to bark like dogs, naked, chained, etc. There is racism involved in these images and in the verbal recordings we have of them. The prisoners were called PUCs, persons under control. They were not given names, and the people who held them did not know what their names were. Similarly, the euphemism, which took them out of the realm of legality, combatants, illegal combatants, put them out of the reach of safety within the Geneva Conventions. They were neither prisoner of war, nor were they civilians who were subject to international protections. They were nothing and no one. So they were called Pax or Hajis, a pejorative word for Muslims. When we look at these photographs and talk about them, we are participating in them. And we have to make our ethics, our stance clear. We have to say, what is the photograph doing to us, and what are we doing with it, other than looking at it and being voyeurs of something awful that happened? Susan Sontag again argues we have to take images seriously. Reversing work that she had done for a long time in one of the last books of her life, she writes against a philosophical bent which can be perhaps epitomized by the work of Baudrillard, who I already quoted from today, the idea of simulacrum, that we live in a period in which there are only images, there are no real things, we cannot differentiate between the real and the representational anymore. Sontag says in one of her last works, bullshit. Images matter. To speak of reality becoming a spectacle in a breathtaking provincialism universalizes the viewing habits of a small, educated population living in the rich part of the world where news has been converted into entertainment. That mature style of viewing, which is a prime acquisition of the modern, and a prerequisite for dismantling traditional forms of party-based politics that offer real disagreement and debate. It assumes that everyone is a spectator. It suggests perversely and seriously that there is no real suffering in the world. But it is absurd to identify the world with those zones in the well-off countries where people have the dubious privilege of being spectators, or of declining to be spectators of other people's pain. Just as it is absurd to generalize about the ability to respond to the sufferings of others on the basis of the mindset of those consumers of news who know nothing at first hand about war and massive injustice and terror. We can only talk about simulacrums if we are not the subjects of suffering ourselves. One of the things I'm wondering about the Abu Ghraib photographs is if they have a similar iconic quality as do the ones of the World Trade Centers and their destruction. And I want to suggest that some reinterpretations of the Abu Ghraib photographs have a horrible potential for reifying the kind of prejudice, racism, and I'm just going to call it bad thinking, that went into what the petty soldiers did to the Iraqi civilians. But there's also a possibility in reinterpretations and reformations of these photographs for subversion, for doing something different. The torture photos of Abu Ghraib were instantly appropriated and recirculated in global and local cultural discourses. The photograph of the hooded Iraqi prisoner standing on a box has become the most emblematic image of the abuse scandal, appearing in innumerable protest artworks and images. His open-armed gesture suggests Christ on the cross. The photo is, quote, an ad for martyrdom made in America. A graphics crew in 2004 took a very popular iPod ad, everybody loves an iPod, and made it into an emblem of the suffering of the prisoners, Iraq. Here, a criticism both of American consumerism and the turning others into a consumable piece of property. Similarly, any number of anti-war posters have used this image. Here, one for asking people to vote, Stop Bush, with an image of the hooded man. And of course, these images have become the subject of, I would argue, anti-American propaganda, which is pretty understandable. Here we see them in a mural in Tehran in 2004, painted. One of the points I want to make is that although, and I would agree with Sontag here, we tend to know about historical and political events through visual forms, they are not, in fact, facts. They have to do with selection. No image is innocent or neutral. Photographs and documentaries are not facts, but involve processes of selecting, highlighting, and juxtaposition. Now, I'm going to only do a moment of this because I need to get to my conclusion. This is roughly a 9-minute bit, and I'd ask you to do a little bit of analysis of it on your own. I'll turn down the lights when we get to it, if I can get to it without Magnus's help. What you can do is look. You could also take notes on what you're seeing if you want to multitask and you want to start to the process of analyzing a 9/11 text. And I'm only going to give you about 4 minutes of it so that I can conclude. You have the lyrics on your handout, a song by Alan Jackson written in commemoration of 9/11. I'm only going to give you about another minute. I want you to see how the next sequence works. The next song. It's the Pledge of Allegiance. Okay, we're just going to see the beginning of the next song so that you can see how the next part works. The bald eagle is crying. Okay, I'm going to give it away. There are 50 stars for 50 fallen soldiers. I'm going to try to hightail through my conclusions, and since that's what you're waiting for, and I'll try to make it brief and pungent in 5 minutes. First of all, what I wanted to talk to you about is how do you start to analyze this kind of text? You can take a lot of the things you already know from literary studies with working with a multimedial and visual image like this. First, I'd ask you to work on form. We heard very saliently last week, form determines content. One of the things you could do with a text like this is take out the sound. Make notes on the visions, the visuals. Then do the opposite. How is the sound being used? Then you could do a genre analysis, something that you're very used to doing with poetry or plays. There are zillions of memorial films like this one. Compare it to some of the other ones. This one is pretty easygoing. There are ones that are a lot more jingoistic and scary. Analyze the visual symbols, the lyrics, the quoted speeches, and the titles and the commentaries. Then think about some of the visuals. How are fade-outs being used? What's the slant? What's the position we're being put in as viewers of this? Then, just as we do with a literary text, look for the dominant metaphors. What's being equated with something else again and again? The star with the foreign soldier, get it, 50 stars. 50 states. How does the text make us see us? Think of the text as an organic form, as doing something with you. What is the frame? How is it being presented? Where? What is the intended audience? Think about the kind of reception it would supposed to have, and I'm using Raymond Williams here, that would be the dominant reception. Then think about a critical or an oppositional form of reception. How could you think of it differently? Have I offered you a turn, something new, a new way of thinking about texts? Not really yet. I have to do that in my conclusions. First, issues involved in reading 9/11 text ethically. They're overwhelmingly visual. I think I've been able to convince you of that. One has to deal with aspects of their visuality in terms of formal analysis. This includes questions of framing, reception, production, and placement. They are spectacular. I mean by that they were made to be seen. The attacks were intended to have a huge symbolic impact. They were based on films like Independence Day. And the Pentagon subsequently asked Hollywood directors to think about the kind of terrorist scenario that could happen in the future. Their imitation and reinterpretation in disaster movies like World Trade Center is something that we need to think about. I would argue that the visuality, the spectacular quality, of these images force us to think, to not allow ourselves to just read for narrative, to naturalize these into a story. We tend to see the visual as fact. We need to divorce ourselves from that and think about form. These are multimedial texts. They appeal to several cognitive processes at once. These have to be analyzed independently from each other. These images have been used and abused to political and ideological ends. Ideological is a loaded word. Terry Eagleton says, when you don't like my politics, you call it ideology. What I mean by that, what is the cultural work that is intended with these texts? What are they supposed to do? What are they supposed to convince people of? Naming intentions and counter-readings is necessary to interpretation. I'm not offering you a whole new show, a whole turn. I am reaffirming what I believe is the initial intention of critical cultural studies. This involves not only a formal analysis and a content analysis of texts, but an analysis of the relationship between forms of knowing and power. The way we know is a form of power. Being straightforward about that and thinking about that is, I believe, an ethical and a political responsibility. These texts involve us in the ethics of interpreting and representing. We cannot stand by indifferently when confronted with an image of Abu Ghraib. Finally, they force us to place ourselves in relationships to the text. I would argue that neutrality is difficult. We have to say where we stand politically to these texts. Thank you very much.